Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is David Gilman. He's an award-winning writer and screenwriter who's written many radio and television scripts, including several years of A Touch of Frost. He's lived all over the world and has found himself in a number of difficult situations in various countries. His new spy thriller, The Englishman, features an MI6 officer, a Moscow CID inspector, and the Russian mafia, and is partly set in Russia. Also joining us is Anna McPartlin, a novelist and scriptwriter from Dublin, who's been writing adult fiction for over 10 years and also writes for children under the name Banny McPartlin. Below the Big Blue is about death, family and finding laughter, even in the most unlikely of places. It's the much anticipated follow-up to the bestseller The Last Days of Rabbit Hayes, which is currently being developed into a film. Also joining us is Sheila O'Flanagan, the author of various bestsellers, including Her Husband's Mistake, The Missing Wife, and All of You, which was the winner of the Irish Independent Popular Fiction Book of the Year Award. Her new novel, The Women Who Ran Away, is about the power of intergenerational female friendship. And finally, on tonight's book show is Jennifer Hoffman. She's a Berlin-based Austrian-American writer and translator. Her novel, The Standardization of Demoralization Procedures, examines obsession, paranoia, and the dwindling career of a Stasi operative. It's set partly in East Berlin in 1989 during the fall of the Wall and 25 years earlier during the Cold War. That's tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
I am unwritten, can't read my mind, I'm undefined. I'm just beginning, the pen's in my hand. Before you open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else can speak the words on your lips. Treat yourself in words unspoken. Live your
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is David Gilman. He's an award-winning author and screenwriter who enjoyed many careers, including a firefighter, paratrooper and photographer, before turning to writing full-time in 1986. He's written many radio and television scripts, including several years of A Touch of Frost. In various times in his life, David's found himself in a number of difficult situations in various countries, like South Africa, East Berlin, and Russia. It's Russia that features prominently in his latest book, The Englishman. It's steeped in corruption and has an association with organized crime. Welcome to the book show, David.
Thank you, Hannah. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks very much for joining us. Before we talk about your latest book, I just want to ask you about a few other things. Working as a firefighter and a paratrooper.
Well, we have to do what we have to do. Let's say that. I was caught up in a situation when I was in my mid to late teens, where I really needed to have a job, and the only way I could do it back then was to lie about my age. So that's what I did. And I got in to the fire brigade where we did fire and rescue. So it was actually a very good learning experience for me.
Yes.
Because we did not only did we do all the types of different fires, but we also ran the ambulance service. So that really opened my eyes to what was going on in the world.
Gosh. Travelling as well. Were you travelling as a writer?
I wasn't back then, no, because I was so young. I hadn't really started. I didn't know where I was heading, quite frankly. I think I took every day as it came, and that was the basis of my life. But I started writing, really, I think, in the late 70s. I had come back to this country. Then I'd been to Australia. I came back to this country, and I thought, well, now's the time. Things didn't work out here for me. So I then married and started my new marriage and a new career in publishing and starting my writing career.
And did you always know at the beginning the kind of books that you wanted to write, and have you stuck with that genre?
No, not at all. Quite the opposite. I started trying to find out how to write, because back in the day there were no books, there were no courses, you couldn't approach anybody, you couldn't get help. You simply had to look and listen to what was out there. And I started writing radio plays, and that really was an amazing experience because it focused the whole visual medium of radio. Because when you listen to radio, you get all those pictures in your mind. And of course, there's a skill with the dialogue and the quietness of the piece that takes the listener with you. And so there's not too great a leap, if you think about it, from radio to novels. Whereas in between, when I moved into television, that demanded another type of discipline because you were literally putting all those images up on the screen, and how you did it and how you wrote it was somewhat different from what you had done before. I hope that makes some sense.
Yes, no, absolutely it does. And which do you think comes more naturally to you, writing for television or writing for radio and books?
I think there's very little difference in my mind's eye, because although when you write a scene for television and you describe where your character is and what they are doing, if you think about it and you transpose that into words on the page, you're almost doing the same thing. What you do have to remember, of course, is that I am going to be writing a scene for an actor. He does this, he does that. It's very cryptic. The director and the actor pick up on that and they run with it. Whereas if I'm writing a scene, shall we say, in my novel, I can expand that. In other words, I am taking on the role of the director as well and guiding the reader's mind's eye towards what I want them to picture. I hope that's fairly clear.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And talking of television and bringing things to life, A Touch of Frost, I mentioned in the introduction, you spent several years writing television scripts. Was it amazing being able to see your stories come to life on television?
You know, you go through quite a long process. It was good to work on A Touch of Frost because it was by invitation. You're invited to write for such a long, well-established show. And what we used to do is I would write a script. I would first of all give a proposal, write a script. Script editors and producer would say, yes, we like that. I then write the script. It goes through a couple of changes. And then we go into rehearsals. And everybody who's in the show would sit around. We used to go down to a theater in the west of London. We'd have a large table. All the actors involved would sit around the table. We'd do a read-through. I would sit opposite Sir David Jason. The executive producers would be on my right. And then beyond us would be the actors reading their parts. And that's where we would thrash out any problems or something that anybody didn't understand within the story. Then, of course, off they go. They shoot it. It comes on television. I watch my first episode and I see it. It's always a thrill, of course. You see everything you've written. And then I don't watch ever again, usually, because we get repeats. And I think, well, occasionally I'll dip in and say, do you know what? That wasn't a bad story after all.
Oh, absolutely. So it's a conscious decision that you choose not to watch it.
Well, in a way, I suppose there's also an underlying little niggle. You think, well, I could have done that better. I could have written that more clear. I could have been sharper with that. So it's almost perhaps a tone of self-criticism as well. But I have to say, look, in all honesty, when I do pick up on watching A Touch of Frost on the telly again, it's good to see the actors working so well together and, you know, in the good direction. So it's a good collaborative effort. It's worked very well.
Yeah, something you can be proud of.
Yes, I think so. Thank you.
Yes. So looking at your new book, The Englishman, there were quite a few things that have happened in your life that inspired the story. You were stationed in Berlin in the 70s, and that kind of inspired a few bits.
Yes, we used to go across into East Berlin on what you might as well call overt intelligence gathering. We used to go across in four-man teams, and we would always try and have a good nose around, see what we could find. We used to go a little bit off-piste, as they say. We were only allowed to go in really certain areas, but we used to go beyond that. And we found, on one stage, we found an armaments dump that we didn't know about. And quite frankly, they don't want you to find out these things, so they would ram you in the car. We used to be in a car. And the East German troops would either ram you, or if you got too close to anything political, they would call in the Stasi. And one day we went down a badly cobbled street. We didn't know where we were. We were hunting out. We'd heard that an English woman had been kept in a prison in East Berlin, and nobody knew where it was. And we came into a big cul-de-sac panhandle. And as we turned the corner, there was this sort of hidden prison, these huge gates. And suddenly a swarm of guards ran at us. So I remember I was driving that day, and we whacked the car into reverse. And we never used to have the greatest of cars, shall we say. The Americans used to have big Ford V8 Galaxies. We had little Austin 1100s. So we were all crammed into that. And I remember slamming it into reverse gear, and of course it wouldn't stay in gear. It used to keep jumping out. So I kept my hand on the reverse gear, spun the wheel, off we went. And what they would do then, if you got too close to a hot spot, the Stasi would come after you, and they would try and ram you in the city. And if that did happen, a diplomatic incident usually arose from it. It happened once to the Americans, I know, and they were boxed in, rammed, and they had blankets thrown over their car, and they were kept in the car for 2 days until everybody moaned and groaned and got through it. But they gave us chase that day, I remember. And so I think those little elements of rattling through the cobbled streets of East Berlin, those, and being chased by the Stasi, I think those things stay with you. And when I did the car chase in London in this book, I suppose there's always elements of that creep in. And so it does influence you, and you never forget those incidents.
Yes, I bet. And what about the Russian connection?
Well, the Russian connection, I think, was triggered pretty much almost subconsciously, I think, unconsciously, because, you know, when we had all the poisoning here and the Russian agents were coming over here, and they clearly almost had a free run at us, I picked up about 2 years ago, I came across a documentary done by an Italian film crew, and they had been given permission to go into eastern Russia in the Urals, the most desolate of places. I mean, the forest alone is bigger than the whole of Germany, shall we say. And there's a penal colony there, and they got into this penal colony. And I watched this and I thought, my God, this really is a hellhole. If you go in there, you're never going to come out. It's that simple, unless you're in a box.
Mm.
And then I thought, well, hang on a minute. I reckon I have a character in mind that if I could get him into the penal colony for whatever reason, I think I know how to get him out. And that was the start of my process.
Okay. And is that Dan Raglan?
That's Dan Raglan.
Okay. So what can you tell us about him?
Well, Dan Raglan, when I was in the Paris in the 70s, I came across quite a few different characters, really quite tough characters. And he's a bit of an amalgamation. But I also came across some French Foreign Legionnaires. And that's always stayed with me. And I thought, well, it would be different to have a hero who was an Englishman who served in the French Foreign Legion. And in the book, I created the reason why, as a young teenager, he was obliged to go into the Legion and how successful he was and how he specialized into there. The Legion has a couple of special forces units, and he got into that. So I've used that as his background, because when he came out of the Legion, he did what they would call freelance asset work for intelligence units, both the UK, French, and a little bit for the USA. So he had a really nice, broad background. But not only that, because there were so really few Englishmen, Americans, foreign nationals who served with him, he has a very close network he can draw on for help and advice.
So there's a kind of team effort in a way then.
It is a team effort. He's very much. I always call him a bit of a knight errant, because he responds to the call for help. But because he can go back and say, hang on a second, I mean, there's an incident in the Englishman, how on earth am I going to get him from UK, from London, into Russia? And there are various steps in the novel how it works. But in one instance, in Poland, he goes through Poland and he uses an ex-Foreign Legion contact to help him get into Russia. So he has that ability to do that.
And I guess you have to do a lot of research into the procedure of all of these things, how it would work.
My books are heavily researched. As you probably know, I've been writing a medieval series for several years, and the amount of research I put into these books takes a long time. So, yes, I am very, very careful and hopefully usually get it right. But the amount of research I do, the people I reach out to, if I may just jump ahead a little bit, for the second book, I had a reader contact me who was reading my medieval series, the Master of War series, and an American guy, and he said, look, if you ever come over to the States, I can get you for a tour around the Pentagon if you feel like it.
So, wow.
That sounds interesting.
Yes.
So I said, yeah, okay, I'm on my way. And anyway, ended up, I went over there and I thought, well, you know, that's probably a security guard and he can probably get me in. And it turned out he's a retired lieutenant colonel in the United States Marine Corps. And I got a personal tour, private tour around the Pentagon in places where members of the public couldn't go. So now I'm incorporating that, of course, into my second Raglan book.
Yes. Oh, brilliant stuff. Well, if people want to read more, find out more about Dan Raglan and his adventures, then they must get a copy of The Englishman. It's available to buy on our website, tre.radio, in the bookshop section there. We've been chatting to the author, David Gilman. David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Hannah. All the best.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from Dublin is Anna McPartlin, a novelist and scriptwriter who's written for TV serial dramas. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel, Below the Big Blue Sky. It's about death, family, and finding laughter, even in the most unlikely of places. It's the much anticipated follow-up to the book club bestseller, The Last Days of Rabbit Hayes, which is currently being developed into a film. Welcome to the book show, Anna.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. And how exciting that the book's being developed into a film.
Oh, yeah, it is very exciting. But look, Anna, it could take the rest of our lives to get it done. I mean, development it sounds fantastic, but actually it's a journey through hell. So
are you very involved in it, or do you just have to kind of sit and wait?
No, I'm very involved. So I am working with a friend of mine who has a small studio, because when The Last Days of Robert Hayes did so well, I was approached by a number of really big companies that wanted to buy it, and I wanted to write it. And when I looked at the contracts, it was very clear to me that they did not trust me to write it. And so they would give me a go, but then they would take it off me. And I just didn't want that. I wanted to write it myself. So my friend said, look, I'm small, but I guarantee you if it won't get made without you. So we are going down the long and hard route, but I'm happy to do it.
Oh, well done. Good for you. And why did it mean so much to you that you were to write it then?
I suppose because I'm screenwriting for television, and I know it's a very different thing to screenwrite for film, and it was brand new to me. But I knew if I had my hand held, which I did, that I'd get it right. And I was scared, and I was scared that somebody, my voice in somebody else's hands would become twee or weird, or the humor wouldn't work, or it would become too sappy. And I was really careful not to let that happen. Mm. You know, delicate balance.
Yeah.
Dark stories with humor is a really delicate balance. And I have lived an entire life of grimness and misery with a sense of humor that I feel perfectly entitled to tell those stories.
Oh, bless you. So tell us a bit more about the character of Rabbit Hayes and the first book without giving too much away.
So the first book, we meet the Rabbit Hayes in a car being driven to a hospice by her lovely mum, Molly Hayes. And we follow her on the last 9 days of her life. And basically, it's her friends, it's her coming to terms with her own death. It's her friends and her family coming to terms with her own death, letting go of hope and basically saying goodbye. And it sounds super grim, but the characters are big and bold and boisterous, and this is a loving family and it's a celebration of life. So what I decided to do with Below the Big Blue Sky is, first of all, the good news is you do not have to have read The Last Days of Robert Hayes. I absolutely made sure that you can read Below the Big Blue Sky on its own. It's written to stand alone. So basically, this is a story about a family who have lost one of their own, and it's about how they completely break down, and it's following over the next 2 years when they bind back together. And again, it's another celebration of love and family bonds and all the things that really matter to us. Mm-hmm. And I think there's no better time than right now to tell those kind of stories about people and the things that actually matter.
Yeah, I applaud you for tackling the subject of death, because it's a subject that people so often avoid, and yet it's something that happens to us all.
Well, it's amazing to me, and it was really weird on the first book. I mean, we did so well with it, but the bloggers were really slow to get on board. And my publisher was scratching their heads going, we're just getting very little response. And then suddenly it just all kicked off when it got into the Richard and Judy show. And all the bloggers came back saying, I'm really sorry. I just kept putting it at the bottom of my to be read list because of the subject matter. I just wasn't able for it. And then when I picked it up and I realized that I was laughing, 1 minute I'd be crying and 2 lines later I was bursting into laughter. Hmm. I would have read this if I had known. So we were really careful on the back of Below the Big Blue Sky to say, look, lads, yes, somebody has died. Yes, you are going to go to an Irish funeral. But yes, you will laugh.
Is it common to laugh at an Irish funeral, would you say?
I'd say there's more laughter at an Irish funeral than there is at an Irish wedding.
Brilliant. I love that.
There's always some L1 in the corner saying something appropriate. And on the other side, there's another L1 that's after milling into the egg and cress sandwiches and has a teeth full of cress, and she's singing a song in the wrong key.
Oh, fantastic. So in one respect, it's a difficult subject to tackle, but in another way, it must be a really fun subject to add humour to, if you like.
It's both difficult and fun. One of the reasons it's easy for me to write about really difficult subjects is because of the life that I've lived. So I am somebody that when you put my life story down on paper, it looks really depressing. But actually, when you meet me, I'm a really joyful person, because through all those times, I've been surrounded by brilliant, bright, joyful people in my life. So that's the thing about Below the Big Blue Sky. The only reason I wrote a follow-up to Rabbit Haze wasn't because Rabbit Haze did so well, because I never intended to write a follow-up. Why I wrote it was because the main character, Molly Haze, the matriarch of the Haze family, is this brilliant, bright, snappy, cool, fabulous, sharp woman. And she's inspired by my mother-in-law, Terry McPartlin. And she's the kind of person, and Terry was the kind of person, that when she loved you, it felt like you were basking in sunshine. Mm. And if she didn't like you, you better run. And run the wind. Because that's the kind of character she was. And so we lost her 4 years ago. And I started, within 6 months of grieving her, I started conceiving Below the Big Blue Sky in my head. So this book was written by somebody who was actively grieving, somebody who she really loved, who was watching her family, her son, her daughters, her husband of 50 years, actively grieving. There was a massive hole in our world, and there always will be without her. But I just wanted to write and get close to her. So she walked around my head and she talked in my head for the entire time I wrote the book. And it was just the best months I've had since she's died.
Oh, how wonderful. So it was probably quite cathartic for you then, writing the book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It really was. And what's been lovely about it is Terry used to be always the first one to read my novels. So I'd print them off the computer and she'd read them page by page. And she just loved reading. She was a massive reader and she'd have her opinions and all her things. And when I told her that Molly Haze was inspired by her in the first one, the first time she read it, she went, "I'm not as bad as her." And I said, "No, Terry, you're better." And she said, "You're damn right I am, love."
Oh, wonderful. And what does your husband think of the book and your take on his mum?
Well, he read The Last Days of Rabbit Haze and he just loved it, absolutely loved it. And you see, a lot of his past was fictionalized in it as well, because he was in a band back in the 80s called Missing Link, and there's twin male characters in it that are best friends with Rabbit's brother Davey, and they are inspired by his friends from that band, and they are the funniest guys you'd ever meet. Like, however funny people think they are in the book, they're 20 times funnier in life. They're just brilliant guys, you know, real smart and real funny. But basically, what I did was I put a lot of that past, because they actually were in a really big band at the time and the lead singer had MS. And so I put a lot of that into the book. So what I did was I took what really happened in all our lives and then I fictionalized it. But it was something that I could write because I knew MS, because my mother had MS. I knew all the stories from the band, so I could create stories of my own. I'd been around bands for 30 years, so I knew how it worked. It wasn't just wasn't just me hearing stories and reiterating. I could actually put myself in that position because I was on tour on the road with my husband. So I put all that energy into the book. So he loved the first book. He hasn't been able to read the second book yet. It's just too raw for him. But my sister-in-law took over my mother-in-law, Terry, being the first one in the family to read the book, which was a great, great honor for me because she's also a reader. So she got it before anybody else and she absolutely loved it. She basically just said, "Look, you just brought her back, Anna. You just brought her back."
Oh, how lovely.
And two sisters have read it and they go, "You just brought back my nanny," which was it was just unbelievable. So, yeah.
Oh, lovely thing to be able to do. And so the characters in the book, one of the big things that happen is obviously the massive amount of grief initially that they all go through, but they all sort of get a bit closer, don't they, because of this?
Yeah. I mean, what happens is they're a very close family to begin with. And what happens is grief comes into the mix and it kind of blows them apart, because everybody grieves in their own way. And so while Jack will lock himself in the attic and try and live in the past by going through all the old diaries. Molly is a doer. And while before she was a house hatcher, she loved to be at home. Now she can't be at home. So she's doing Meals on Wheels or, you know, feeding the poor or getting out of the house, doing anything that stops her from thinking. Grace is doing her own thing because, unfortunately, Rabbit had the BRCA gene and Grace has done the test and now she's on a completely different journey of her own while grieving her sister. And then you've got Davey, poor Davey, who was living a rock and roll lifestyle that he was too old to live in Nashville. And basically now he is taking care of a young girl who is grieving for her mother, 12-year-old Juliet, who is lost, just lost in the world, and is so used to being a caretaker that you're not really sure who's taking care of who when it comes to Davey and Juliet. And then you have Marjorie, Rabbit's best friend, and almost adopted in by the family when she was very young. And now she's adrift because without Rabbit, she doesn't feel tethered to the family anymore. So she hasn't just lost Rabbit. She feels she's lost the Hayes family, which is a massive blow to her. And it's about all these characters finding their way back to one another. Mm. And trust me, it sounds horrific, but it's not.
Is it? I mean, is it difficult when you describe it like that? As you say, it sounds really sad. You know, it sounds like they're all going through this really sad journey. How do you make stuff like that funny?
You see, I don't know. I speak that all the time. I don't know because it's funny. Like when I write Molly Hayes, I think, well, what would Terry do? And whatever Terry does is hilarious because that's just who she was. And when I write the twins, I think, what would Jerry Bennett think of this? Oh, I know. And I do that. Or I think, you know, when I go and talk about Juliet or Rabbit, I kind of go into myself and I go, well, how would I handle that in my scenario? And 9 times out of 10, for whatever reason, one minute it will be really, really sad. And the next minute you will be going, I cannot believe she said that.
Oh, fabulous. So it must have been lovely to write about these characters again. I know you said initially you weren't intending to do a follow-up. So then when the follow-up happened, it must have been nice to be with the people again.
Oh, it was just amazing, especially under the circumstance. And the book just flowed out of me. I mean, I didn't put down one hard day writing every single day. And I overwrote to the point where my poor publisher had to like slash the book in half. And it's still a big book. She was like, Anna, seriously? It's like the law of scriptures, you know what I mean?
Oh, brilliant. So your next book presumably will be a whole new set of characters. Have you left these ones behind, do you think, now?
Well, I would love to do a third book, and I have exactly the idea to do it. But I will only do that if there's interest in this one. Now, so far, the reviews have been stunning. I'm like blown away by them. Like, because I was really scared, and like I was terrified that, you know, I'd mess up the legacy of Rabbit, or it wouldn't live up. So I've never had a more anxious or stressful release of a book in my life. Like I've lost every pound I put on for COVID. I've lost through pure stress, and I have a lip full of cold sores. I broke out massive cold sores. I haven't eaten in a week and a half. I literally have been stressed out of my bin. And then the reviews started coming in, and I'm starting to be able to hold something down, and the lip doesn't look like there's a small village populating it as much as it did last week. So things are looking up. So loads of the readers are saying, I'm on this platform called The Pigeonhole, which is really cool. It offers people the chance to read the book a chapter a day on this digital platform, and they can communicate with each other and they can communicate with me. And then they go off and they put reviews everywhere, and they're all saying, we want these characters back, we want them back. So if there is a demand, I know exactly how to end the Hayes saga. I absolutely know. I know the last page of the... So I'd love to do it. But in the meantime, yes, I do have another book coming out probably next summer.
Okay, well, we'd love to speak to you next summer about the next book. But in the meantime, best of luck with this one. It's called Below the Big Blue Sky, and it's by Anna McPartlin, who we've been chatting to. Anna, it's been really lovely to chat with you today.
pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, and love to all your listeners. Mind yourselves.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Sheila O'Flanagan. She's the author of best-selling chart toppers, including Her Husband's Mistake, The Hideaway, The Missing Wife, and All For You, which was the winner of the Irish Independent Popular Fiction Book of the Year Award. After working in banking and finance for a number of years, Sheila's love for writing blossomed into curating stories about relationships in all their many forms. Her latest book is called The Women Who Ran Away, and it's about the power of intergenerational female friendship. Welcome to the book show, Sheila.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. So dare I ask how long you've been writing for now?
I've been published now for about 24 years or 25 years, but I was one of those people who I was a kid who used to write. I was always writing, so it's just part of my DNA, I think.
Yeah. And did you think when you first started, when you published that first book, that it would turn into such an amazing career?
Absolutely not. I always wanted to write. I always wanted to have a book published. That was kind of the dream. But I truly felt that if I got one book published, that would be it, and I would be happy. But it's just turned into something I never imagined.
Yeah. And each time you go to write a new book, do you think, right, what on earth am I going to do this time? Or have you got loads of ideas all ready to go?
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, I'm fingers crossed, because, I was terrified that the ideas will dry up. But there's so much goes on, in life and in the world. And there are always things that spark off ideas. And the book might not turn out to be what I thought at the start, but they're so far so good. There has always been something that I've wanted to write about.
Yeah. And do you have a clear idea of where the story is going to go and what's going to happen at the end before you write? Or is it, do you see what happens?
I'm the way they talk about this, they say you're either a plotter or a pantser, so you either plot or you go by the seat of your pants, and I'm more the seat of your pants sort of person. I have an idea at the very start, and then I start to write, and it kind of can go a few different ways. So I'm never really sure. About the final third, I have a better idea of where it's going to end up. But when I start, I'm never really certain.
And I would say that's more exciting for you as an author to do it like that.
Well, it kind of is. And I think, you do get invested in the characters when you're writing them. And it is a bit of a cliche, I guess, but they do take on a life of their own, and they do develop as you're writing them. And then things that you might have thought would work, you realise, no, these characters never do that. They're going off in their own direction, and you can't stop them. And it's great to go on the journey with them.
Yeah. And those of your books that have done particularly well, the ones that have won awards or sold the most, do you think it's easy to identify or understand why those in particular have done so well?
I'm not sure exactly, but I think possibly maybe the themes in them the themes in them, and perhaps the characters as well, just resonate particularly well with my readers, and they identify, I guess, with those characters perhaps more.
Yeah, that makes a difference, doesn't it? I think for a lot of people, and maybe a lot of women reading these types of books particularly, if you can think, oh, that's so much like my friend, or, oh, yes, I've done that a million times, or it makes such a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I've had messages from readers that are saying, oh, my God, I knew she was going to do this, and I was screeching at her not to do it. And I love that. I love when my readers, get so involved in the book that they are literally shouting at the characters and saying, please don't, or whatever, So yeah, I want, for me, the characters become like friends, and that's what I want my readers to feel as well, that the characters are people that they could know and people that they could be friends with.
Mm. And are all your books standalone? Have you done any series?
All of my novels are standalone. I'm not really good on the whole idea of a sequel because I feel that you're going to have to put them all through the mill again, you know. And if, but unless I was doing a really long saga, I think I prefer doing standalones. But some readers have asked, you know, about particular characters from time to time. They said, oh, you know, I'd love a sequel to that. So what I do occasionally is I've published three collections of short stories, and I have brought back characters from my novels in the short stories.
Oh, lovely. It must be difficult when you've finished a book and, as you say, really got invested in the characters and their lives to say goodbye to them, you know, when the book is over. I guess it's a mixture of relief and maybe sadness.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, when you're getting towards the end, you're actually in sort of writing faster because you really want to get to the end of the story, and yet you're also slowing down because you don't want to leave the characters behind, you know. And so it is hard, and they do stay in your head for a while, and you know, in the end you do have to let them go, but they have occupied your head for a long time, and it is like saying goodbye to really close friends.
Yeah. So tell us about the two women in this book.
The women who ran away. Well, it's a book about two women who meet on a car ferry going from Ireland to France. And it's only, they're traveling alone, which is sort of unusual because normally, as you probably know yourself, those car ferries, same from UK to France, you know, it's usually families and they're going on camping holidays. But these two women have both different reasons for traveling alone. And Grace, who's in her early 60s, she has a plan for her travel. She's actually fulfilling the wishes of her late husband, and she has her whole itinerary mapped out for her, and she has things that he has asked her to do, and she's going to do them. So she's very organized. And Deira, who is just approaching her 40s, has no plan at all. She's kind of taken the holiday that she was meant to be taking with her now ex-partner of 12 years, and it was a really, really messy breakup, and she's struggling with it. And one of the things that sort of, you know, is a bit of a theme going through the book, or informed me or inspired me, was a quote from Hemingway. And he says, you can't get away from yourself by moving from place to place. Hmm. And so as the women are traveling, those things that have set them off on the travel have, you know, are coming back to them over and over again, you know. So they were initially traveling separately, but circumstances have ended up making them travel together. And so as they travel together, they are realizing that you can't move away from the things that have made you the person you are. But, you know, they support each other and they learn from each other. And hopefully they put some things about each other's lives in context, even though they don't always agree with each other and they argue with each other. So, I mean, I think it's a good representation of women who become friends, women and their close friendships, you know, that we do argue and we do offer unwanted advice sometimes, but you know, hopefully we're very supportive for each other in the end. And of course, with this book, because they traveled through France and through Spain, I'm bringing them to some of my favorite locations in both countries.
Oh, fabulous. Like, give us an example, like where?
Well, they go through along the west coast of France. So they go through La Rochelle, which is one of the most beautiful places in France, and actually one of my favorite places to go. And then when they come through Spain, they stop in Pamplona, which is lovely. I love Pamplona, and Toledo, which is also beautiful. And then they come down the center of Spain and they stay in Granada, which again is one of my favorite places. I mean, I was talking about this before to somebody and I said, okay, I keep saying my favorite places, but I have problems to all of my favorite places.
It's okay to have 10 favorite places.
And then they end up in Cartagena, where Grace actually has a holiday home.
Okay. Fabulous. So I love the idea as well, that the female friendship between these two women, that are not only very different people and in different stages of their lives, that the different ages as well. I love that. We have a lot of that living abroad, becoming friends with people who are completely different age and background to you, which I think is less likely to happen in your home country. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because, you know, in our home country, we've kind of got ourselves into a particular, I suppose, we've got a circle of friends and we've got a circle of things that we do and everything. And when you move away, you do have to make new friends, and they're not necessarily going to be the same kind of people even that you would have met in your hometown where, you know people and you know everything about it. So you have to make an effort, I think, if you move somewhere else. And, I have friends who are a good bit older than me and a good bit younger than me. And you learn from both sides of it, you know. And I really like the fact that these days we are much more mobile in our friendships.
Yeah, and that's true. That's a big thing. You can learn a lot from someone older than you, and you can also learn a lot from someone younger than you. So there's huge benefits both ways.
Yeah, I think in the book, Grace, who has led a very, I wouldn't like to say sheltered life, but, you know, a very ordinary life and has not stepped outside her comfort zone, really. With Dira alongside her, she learns to do that. And again, Dira, who is looking at things and taking them all really personally and internalizing everything, learns to just to kind of be a little bit more accepting of things and not to be quite so judgmental about herself. Mm. So women are able to offer each other advice. And I do believe, yeah, that with different age groups, different experiences, we can help each other a lot more.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's a lovely idea for a story. It's called The Women Who Ran Away, and it's available to buy on our website, tre.radio, in the bookshop section there. And it's by Sheila O'Flanagan, who we've been chatting to. Sheila, thanks so much for joining us. Lovely to chat with you.
It was my absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Jennifer Hoffman, who's a Berlin-based Austrian-American writer and translator. She's with us on the book show to talk about her novel, The Standardization of Demoralization Procedures. It examines obsession, paranoia, and the dwindling career of a Stasi operative. It's partly set in East Berlin on the 9th of November 1989, the day the Berlin Wall will fall, and also 25 years earlier during the Cold War. Welcome to the book show, Jennifer.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Thank you for joining us. So tell me a little bit about your background and how and why you came to write this book.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a long story, but I was born in the U.S. to an Austrian father and a Colombian mother. So I grew up speaking German at home, even though we were in the United States. And then we moved back to Austria and then Germany, where I mostly grew up. So I grew up in Hanover. Well, I couldn't say I really grew up there, but I spent a lot of time in Hanover, which is northern Germany and West Germany, former West Germany. And then I moved back to the U.S. and I went to school and college, and I moved back to Germany, to Berlin, where obviously it was split in half, but I moved to former East Berlin. And I started speaking to people, you know, started making friends and met their parents and grandparents who all lived in former East Germany. And it started dawning on me that a good portion of Germany lived in a completely different system, economically and psychologically. And from one day to the next, it was decided that their home and their history would be erased. And I became very interested in what that does to people. And I was confronted with a lot of stories, so weird and atrocious, but also very joyful and absurdly funny. And I started collecting them, and they fed a lot of the anecdotal evidence in this novel.
Oh, fascinating. So you've met and spoken to a lot of people then who were around at that time and really experienced what life was like being in Berlin when the wall came down.
Exactly. So that's what really sparked my interest in these stories. And they were random conversations with taxi drivers and people fixing my smoke detectors or my kitchen, you know, just chats here and there that really turned into interviews for me. They didn't know that, but
yeah, fascinating. And what about the Cold War 25 years earlier? Where does that come into the story?
You know, I was crafting this character in an attempt to explore how the people operating the system became that way. And I was interested in, you know, their post-war experience and what shaped their psychology. and what really led them to make these choices, small choices, big choices along the way, to build this really atrocious system. And the parts in the book 25 years earlier are a decisive moment for this protagonist and the choices that he made without thinking too much about them at the time and now feeling the repercussions. So, I had to backtrack a little bit to flesh that out.
So what can you tell us about the protagonist?
He is a typical German white male, born during the war, but grew up mostly post-war, with a very unique German post-war experience, with a very German psychology at the end of the day. And he was instrumental in building the system, though behind the scenes. And he is torn between self-actualization and following the system, following orders. A lot of the tension for this character comes from there. there's a lot to say about him, but he's basically on the surface a very typical German citizen.
Do we like him? Do we sympathize with him? Are we kind of on his side as a reader?
I expressly don't want to answer that, because that's really part of what this novel is about for me, that I would like readers, as far as they can, to empathize even with the more, quote, evil things that he does. And I really attempted to explore some of the reasons why people might make those choices in their life. So I hope it's both. Mm. I hope people recognize some of his psychology in themselves. That is really what I would like to achieve.
Yeah. And what about the title of the book, the standardization of demoralization procedures? What does that mean?
Yeah. It is actually, it's the title of the manual that Dan Seiga, the protagonist, wrote for the Stasi, which is a manual that describes procedures with which the Stasi can demoralize individuals or groups. This is based on a manual like this did not really exist. There were loose outlines of how the Stasi would accomplish these procedures, but they weren't actually compiled into a manual as such. So I took the creative license of creating this manual within the novel and titling it The Standardization of Demoralization Procedures.
And how long did it take you to write the book? Was it quite a long process?
Yes and no. I think I had, there were attempts as far back as 10 years ago, but I kept starting over and over, and the real reasons and thoughts behind writing it just kept evolving. And the shape it is in now took about 4 or 5 years. Okay. So quite a while. Yeah.
And did you have to do quite a bit of research for the book, I imagine?
Yes, I did. But luckily, Germany is very good at keeping records. There's one thing they're good at, keeping records.
Yeah.
So outstanding archives in Berlin. And so there was a lot of research, a lot of reading. But like I said, just also a lot of interviews with people.
So do you think that your next book, then, if you're going to write another book, would it be around a similar subject or something entirely different?
It will be about something entirely different. I can't speak too much about it because I don't want to jinx the process, but I'm in the process of writing now, and it's not set in Germany. It's not about Berlin. It's a very different topic.
Okay.
But yeah.
And has it been nice to do something a bit different? Did you do that on purpose?
Oh, yeah, totally. It was very nice to write. It's amazing to be writing about something other than the dark and gloomy Berlin.
Yeah.
And enjoying that, yes. Yeah, because you lock yourself into certain topics and you set parameters for how a story can go and the psychology of a protagonist, and it becomes quite tedious, especially if it's such a pedantic protagonist as Bernd Saiga is in this.
Well, if people want to get a copy of The Standardization of Demoralization Procedures, it is available on our website in the TRE bookshop section. It's by Jennifer Hoffman, who we've been chatting to. Jennifer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels, and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.